And it's actually interesting to see how the way in which the commissioners take a conservative line, that they're saying we don't want to provide refuge. We want to constrain this. But at the same time, they're arguing what becomes a very much a, yes, a prototypical liberal argument against indentured labor. So they're saying indentured labor is not exactly freedom, therefore these refugees are not necessarily receiving a better life, therefore maybe we shouldn't provide it at all. So it's a moralistic argumentation about what's right in a broader notion outside of law, but one that they're looking at and considering weighing much more than they're weighing, at least with commissioners, any of Vattel, De Wolf, Pufendorf. The grades of legal theory are not actually entering the equation at all. This is about a matter of what is going on the ground. So we have the space of empire. We also have the finances related to the space, whether or not we want to afford this. We have the, and what comes out of that is a diplomatic clout. Are we going to wield our authority in order to reach those ends? Answer, future slaves, not necessarily the case. And also the zeal. Now, is this classically 19th century British civilizing mission working? So in terms of the moral codes of the 1870s, the answer seems to be no, it's not working, we need to rethink this, potentially. And again, both in a sort of conservative direction, but also in a, it will become a more, a broader human rights campaign against the woes of indentured labor, etc., into the 20th century, starting by 35 here. So I chose this case for reasons of a break in my broader chronology, but also because I think it has many parallels because of it's part of this break that continues, as far as I've seen it, into the 1930s and 1940s. And the other case that I talk about a great length in the paper, are these schemes to resettle refugees, international schemes at this point, not just British ones, to resettle refugees from Central and Eastern Europe in the British colonies. And in this case, we're looking at mostly European Jews, though not exclusively. And they're looking at a time when they're again questioning, and again in very moralistic terms, whether or not they can afford, right? And afford is both ideological, can they afford it? It's a diplomatic, it's not diplomatic in terms of international diplomacy at this point, but in terms of their relations with their colonial populations, whether they can afford to resettle foreign refugees in areas where they have to be concerned with what is going on the ground in the colony. So again, we have a pivot, one right, potential right, versus another potential right, butting up against each other in that you have refugees who the British believe that they ought to be able to resettle, that they ought to help out resettling, since they're asking that of the international community as well. They ought to resettle some of them in their own empire. But a realization that so many places in their own empire are now experiencing nationalist movements, labor unrest, etc. Even the ones, British Guiana and East Africa, both areas in which labor unrest makes this the quote-unquote empty land on which refugees would be settled, areas in which maybe the local populations have a better right to better claim on these lands, again, constructed in two competing rights categories. So, to move from these, again, very different cases to a question of contested histories of human rights more specifically, what I want to emphasize and to leave you with from these two cases and from my project as a whole is sort of a bottom line for me. What's interesting is how much empire continues to matter into the 1930s and 40s as a space for refuge, but more broadly speaking, how much refuge and whether or not refuge can be seen out to its conclusions, whether or not that can happen depends on resources, which is something I think we often forget when we talk about the construction of rights as such. And what I want to show is not just that they both matter, right, which we can accept that they both matter, but that humanitarian norm as I would call it, or normative claims rather than necessarily rights as such, because it gets to be encoded in or framed in rights language. But these normative claims and normative responsibilities that get accrued around the category of refugee and the idea of providing asylum only become potentially universal in application because there are the resources with which the British are able to do it. That by the time those resources seem maxed out to capacity, the 1870s, which whether or not we agree that they were actually maxed out is a different question, but they were assumed to be at capacity at that point. It's at that point when the British start looking international. It's at that point when this claim about a right to refuge can't just be for the British a British tradition or a British exercise. It has to be international. So if we look at an arc to, you know, maybe not human rights, but human rights discourse or normative normative claims about rights, it is, you know, on the one hand, a continuity of needing resources, a continuity of needing of expanding potential inclusion. But the British ability to do so winds up lopping off fugitive slaves, winds up contracting in a way that it's contracting, and the ability to follow through is contracting and winding up with a smaller and smaller group within British law and international policy as to who gets included, while the baseline agreement or cultural agreement as to who ought to be included is itself at least the same as it was in the middle of the 19th century, if not expanding to greater and greater levels. So again, thinking about what gets included, whether there's an arc, human rights, you know, again, we can see the substantial contraction, but that contraction only happens at a point when it's realized that it's so potentially broad that it's not affordable.